hated Gavilar, Amaram, me and Thanadol, once we knew the secrets? What is it about the Sons of Honor that frightens them? Vale hesitated.
You found her, Pattern said in her mind. Do you have evidence like Dalinar wanted?
They'll send you after Astaris next, ELA said. But they'll watch you. In case you rise high enough, learn enough to threaten them. Have you asked yourself what they want? What they expect to get out of the end of the world?
Power, Vale said.
Ah, nebulous power. No, it is more specific than that. Most of the Sons of Honor simply wanted their gods back. But Gavilar saw more. He saw entire worlds.
Tell me more, Vale said.
Shouts sounded outside the room. Vale glanced at the door in time to see a brilliant shard blade slice through the lock. Adolin, wearing the false face she'd given him, kicked open the door a moment later. People flooded in around him, soldiers and five of Shallan's Lightweaver agents.
Once I'm dead, ELA hissed, don't let them search my rooms before you do.
Look for the rarest vintage.
It is exotic.
Don't give me riddles, the three said. Give me answers. What are the Ghost Bloods trying to do?
ELA closed her eyes.
Do it!
Instead, the three dismissed her blade.
I vote against killing her, Vale thought.
Killing her would mean she had been manipulated by Marais. She hated that idea.
You're not dying today, the three said.
I have more questions for you.
ELA kept her eyes closed.
I won't get to answer. They won't let me.
Shallan emerged, calming her nerves as several soldiers rushed up to surround ELA. Vale and Radiant settled back, both pleased at this outcome. They were their own person. They did not belong to Marais. She shook her head and trotted over to Adolin, then dismissed his illusory face with a touch. She needed to see him as himself.
Which one are you? He asked quietly, giving her a pouch of infused spheres.
Shallan, she said, putting the pouch into her satchel, which a soldier had fetched for her from beside the wall. She glanced over her shoulder as the soldiers bound ELA. And again, Shallan was struck by how deflated the woman looked.
Adolin pulled Shallan close. Did she confess to you?
She danced around it, Shallan said. But I think I can make a case to Dalinar that what she said constitutes treason. She wants to depose Yasna and put Elokar's son on the throne.
Gavinar's way too young.
And she'd be guiding him, Shallan said. Which is why she's a traitor. She wants the power.
But ELA had spoken like that plan was in the past, as if she were now fighting only for survival. Had the Ghost Bloods truly killed High Princes Thanadol and Vama?
Well, Adolin said, with her in custody, perhaps we can get her armies to stand down. We can't afford a war with our own right now.
Ishna,
Shallan called, drawing the attention of one of her agents. The short Alethi woman hastened over. She'd been with Shallan for over a year now, and along with Vatha, leader of the deserters that Shallan had recruited, was one of those she trusted most.
Yeah, Brightness? Ishna asked.
Take Vatha and Beryl. Go with those soldiers and make certain they don't let ELA speak to anyone. Gag her if you have to. She has a way of getting inside people's heads.
Consider it done, Ishna said. You want to put the illusion on her first?
The contingency plan for extraction was simple. They'd use light weaving to make themselves into House Sadius guards and ELA into someone lowborn. They'd march her out the gates with ease, capturing the High Princess right out from underneath the watchful eyes of her guards.
Yes, Shallan said, waving the soldiers to bring the woman over.
ELA walked with her eyes closed, still maintaining her fatalistic air. Shallan took ELA by the arm, then breathed out and let the light weavings surround her, changing the woman to look like one of the sketches Shallan had done recently, a kitchen woman with rosy cheeks and a wide smile. ELA didn't deserve such a kindly face, nor did she deserve such a light treatment. Shallan felt an unexpected spike of disgust at touching ELA. This creature and her husband had plotted and executed a terrible plan to betray Dalinar. Even after the move to Urithiru, ELA had worked to undermine him at every opportunity. If this woman had gotten her way, Adolin would have died before Shallan met him. And now they were just going to take her in to play more games? Shallan let go, hand going to her satchel. Radiant was the one who emerged, however. She grabbed ELA by her arm and towed her over to Adolin's soldiers, handing her off.
"Take her out with the others," Adolin said.
"You got the rest of the conspirators?" Shallan asked, walking back to him.
"They tried to escape out the side doors we burst in, but I think we managed to round them all up."
Ishna and the soldiers, Adolin's men, hand-picked from among his finest, led the disguised and bound ELA out the door. The High Princess sagged in their grip. Adolin watched her go, a frown on his lips.
"You're thinking," Shallan said, "that we shouldn't have ever let her leave Urithiru, that it'd be easier if we'd ended her and the threat she represented before it went this far."
"I'm thinking," Adolin said, "that maybe we don't want to travel that road."
"Maybe we started already. Back when you—"
Adolin drew his lips to a line.
"I don't have any answers right now," he eventually said. "I don't know if I ever did. But we should ransack this place quickly. Father might want more proof than your word, and it would be awfully helpful if we could present him with incriminating journals or letters."
Shallan nodded, waving over Gaz and Red. She would have them search the place. And what of what ELA had said? "Look for the rarest vintage." Shallan eyed the wines set out on the counter of the hutch. "Why speak in riddles?" Adolin and the others were coming in, Shallan thought. She didn't want them to understand. Storms. The woman had grown paranoid. But why trust Shallan?
"I won't get to answer. They won't let me."
"Adolin," she said, "something is wrong with this. With ELA. With me being here. With—" She cut herself off as shouts sounded in the antechamber. Shallan scrambled out, feeling a sense of dread. She found ELA Sadius lying on the floor, foam coming from the mouth of her fake face. The soldiers watched with horror. The High Princess stared up with lifeless eyes. Dead.
Kaladin flew through the smoke billowing up over the manor. He soared down toward where the townspeople were being threatened by the strange fused and his soldiers. That was Weber, the manor's gardener, being held against the ground with a boot to his face.
"This is obviously a trap," Syl said in Kaladin's mind. "That fused knows exactly what to do in order to draw the attention of a windrunner. Attack innocence."
She was right. Kaladin forced himself to drop carefully a short distance away. The fused had torn a hole in the wall around a side entrance of the manor. Though flames licked the upper floors of the structure, the room beyond the hole was dark, not yet afire. At least, not completely. As soon as Kaladin landed, the singers released Weber and the others, then retreated through the broken hole in the stone wall. 5 soldiers, Kaladin noted, 3 with swords, 2 with spears. The fused carried 1 captive as he strode into the building. Thin, with a gaunt face, the captive was bleeding from a slash along his stomach. Godeki the Edge Dancer. His stormlight had apparently run out. Storm's Sandy was still alive. The fused wanted to use him as bait, so the chances seemed good. Kaladin strode toward the broken wall.
"You want to fight me, fused? Come on, let's have at it!"
The creature, shattered inside the building, growled something in his own rhythmic language. One of the soldiers translated.
I will fight you inside where you cannot fly away, little windrunner. Come, face me.
I don't like this, Syl said.
Agreed, Kaladin whispered. Be ready to go get help. He lashed himself upward slightly, enough to make him lighter on his feet, then inched into the burning building. This large room had once been the dining chamber where Kaladin's father had eaten with Roshon and talked of thieves and compromises. The ceiling was burned in patches, the fire consuming it from above. Flamespren danced along the wood with a frantic delight. The hulking fused stood directly ahead, two soldiers at each side. They moved forward to flank Kaladin. Where was the fifth soldier? There, near an overturned table, fiddling with something that glowed a deep violet black. Void light? Wait, was that a Fabriel? The light dimmed suddenly. Kaladin's powers vanished. He felt it as a strange smothering sensation, as if something heavy had been placed on top of his mind. His full weight came upon him again, his lashing cancelled. Syl gasped, and her spear puffed away as she became a spren, and when Kaladin tried to resummon his blade, nothing happened. Immediately Kaladin stepped backward to try to escape the range of the strange Fabriel, but the soldiers quickly rushed to surround him, cutting off his retreat. Kaladin's assumption that he could beat them easily had relied on his shard spear and his powers. Storms! Kaladin strained to create a lashing. Stormlight still raged inside him and kept him from needing to breathe the acrid smoke, but something was suppressing his other abilities. The fused laughed and spoke in Alethi.
Radiance, you rely too much on your powers. Without them, what are you? A peasant child with no real training in the art of warfare, or...
Kaladin slammed himself against the soldier to his right. The sudden motion caused the singer to cry out and fall backward. Kaladin yanked the spear from the man's hand, then, in a fluid motion, whipped it into a two-handed lunge, impaling the second soldier. The two soldiers on his left recovered and leaped for him. Kaladin felt the wind encircle him as he spun between the two of them, catching one sword, aimed low, with the butt of his spear as he caught the second one, aimed high, right behind the spear's head. Metal met wood with a familiar thunk, and Kaladin finished his spin, throwing off both weapons. He gutted one man, then tripped him, sending him stumbling to the ground in front of his ally. These soldiers were trained well but hadn't seen much actual combat yet, as evidenced by how the remaining singer froze when he saw his friends dying. Kaladin kept moving, almost without thought, spearing the fourth soldier in the neck. There, Kaladin thought as the expected ribbon of red light came darting toward him. He will go for my back again. Kaladin dropped his spear, pulling a throwing knife off his belt and turned. He rammed the knife into the air right before the fused appeared, slamming the small blade into the creature's neck, angled between two pieces of carapace. The fused let out an irk of shock and pain, his eyes wide. Fire made wood snap overhead and burning cinders dropped down as the enormous fused toppled forward like a felled tree, the floorboards shaking with the impact. Blessedly, no red ribbon of light rose from him this time.
That's a relief, Syl said, landing on Kaladin's shoulder. I guess if you catch him before he teleports, you really can kill him.
At least until the Everstorm rebirths him, Kaladin said, checking the singers he'd killed. Other than the one dying slowly from the gut wound, he'd left only two alive, the one he'd shoved and the fifth one, across the room, who had activated the Fabriel. The former had scrambled out the gaping hole in the wall to escape. The latter had left the Fabriel and was inching to the side, his sword out, eyes wide. The man was trying to reach Godeki, perhaps to use him as a hostage. In the fray, the wounded Edge Dancer had fallen to the ground beside the husk after the fused had teleported to Kaladin. Godeki was now moving, but not under his own power. A small, gangly figure had the Edge Dancer by one leg and was slowly dragging him away from the fight. Kaladin hadn't seen Lyft sneak into the room, but then again, she often showed up where one did not expect her. "Take him out the hole, Lyft," Kaladin said, stepping toward the last singer. "Are your powers suppressed, too?"
"Yeah," she said. "What'd they do to us?" "I'm extremely curious about this, too," Syl said, zipping over to the device on the floor, a gemstone covered in metal pieces and resting on tripod legs. "That is a very strange Fabriel."
Kaladin pointed his spear at the last singer, who, hesitantly, dropped his sword and raised his hands. He had a jagged skin pattern of red and black. "What is that, Fabriel?" Kaladin asked.
I...
The soldier swallowed.
"I don't know. I was told to twist the gemstone at the base to activate it."
"That's void light powering it," Syl said. "I've never seen anything like it."
Kaladin glanced at the smoke pooling on the ceiling.
"Lift," he said.
"On it,"
she said, scrambling over to the device while Kaladin kept the soldier guarded. A moment later, Kaladin's powers returned. He sighed in relief, though that made Stormlight puff before him. Nearby, Godeki gasped, unconsciously breathing in Stormlight, and his wound started to heal. Strengthened by the light, Kaladin grabbed the soldier and lifted him up, infusing him enough to make him hang in the air.
"I told you to leave the city," Kaladin growled softly. "I'm memorizing your face, your pattern, your stench. If I see you again, ever, I will send you hurtling upward with so much stormlight that you will have a long, long time to think during the fall back down. Understood?"
The singer nodded, humming a conciliatory sound. Kaladin shoved him, recovering his stormlight and making the man fall to the ground. He scrambled away out the hole.
"There was another human in here," Lift said. "An old light-eyed man in beggar's clothing. I was watching him from outside the building and saw the man come in here with Godeki. A short time later, that fused broke through the wall carrying Godeki. But I didn't spot the other man."
Roshon. The former city lord had told Dalinar he was going to search the manor's storm cellar to free imprisoned townspeople. Though he wasn't proud of it, Kaladin hesitated, but when Syl looked at him, he gritted his teeth and nodded.
"So long as it is right," he thought.
"I'll find him," Kaladin said. "Make sure Godeki recovers, then get that Fabriel to Brightness Navani. She's going to find it very interesting."
Shallan removed the illusion, revealing Ile's face, spittle dripping from her lips. One of Adolin's men checked her pulse, confirming it. She was dead.
"Damnation," Adolin said, standing helpless above the body. "What happened?"
"We didn't do this," Vale thought. "We decided not to kill her, right?" Shallan's mind began to fuzz, everything feeling blurry. Had she done this? She'd wanted to, but she hadn't, had she? She was more in control than that. "I didn't do it," Shallan thought. She was reasonably certain.
"So what happened?" Radiant asked. "She must have taken poison," said Vatha, leaning down. "Blackbane."
Even after many months as Shallan's squire and then agent, the former deserter didn't look like he belonged with Adolin's soldiers. Vatha was too rough. Not sloppy, but unlike Adolin's men, he didn't care much for the spit and polish. He showed his disdain by leaving his jacket undone, his hair messy.
"I've seen someone die like that before, Brightness," he explained. "Back in Sadius's army, an officer was smuggling and selling supplies. When he finally got found out, he poisoned himself rather than be taken."
"I didn't see her do it," Ishna said, sheepish. "I'm sorry."
"Nails nuts," muttered one of Adolin's soldiers. "This is going to look bad, isn't it? This is exactly what the Blackthorn didn't want. Another Sadius corpse on her hands."
Adolin drew in a long, deep breath.
"We have enough evidence to have seen her hanged. My father will simply have to accept that. We'll bring troops to the war camps to make certain her soldiers don't get rowdy. Storms! This mess should have been cleaned up months ago."
He pointed at several soldiers. "Check the other conspirators for poison and gag them all. Shallan will disguise the body like a rug or something so we can get it out. Gen and Natum, search ELA's things in the next room to see if you can find any useful evidence."
"No," Shallan said.
Adolin froze, glancing at her.
I'll search through ELA's things in the next room. I know what to watch for, and your soldiers don't. You handle the captives and search the rest of the building.
Good idea, Adolin said. He rubbed his brow, but then, perhaps seeing the little anxiety spren that appeared near her, like a twisting black cross, smiled.
Don't worry. Every mission has a few hitches.
She nodded, more to put him at ease than to indicate her real feelings. As the soldiers moved to follow his orders, she knelt by Ile's body. Ishna joined her.
Brightness, do you need something?
She didn't eat poison, did she? Shallan asked softly.
Can't be certain, Ishna said. I know a little about Blackbane, though.
She blushed.
Well, I know a lot. My gang would use it on rivals. It's tough to make, because you need to dry the leaves out, then make a gum out of them to get it to full potency. Anyway, eating it isn't the best. If you can get it into the blood, though, it kills quickly.
She trailed off, frowning, perhaps realizing, as Shallan had, that Ile had died very quickly. Shallan knew of Blackbane herself. She'd studied up on poisons recently.
Would I be able to spot a pinprick? Shallan thought, kneeling beside the corpse.
Either way, she suspected Ile had been right. The ghost bloods hadn't trusted Shallan to kill her, and they'd sent a second knife to see the job done. That would mean they had an operative among Adolin's guards, or Shallan's own agents. The idea made Shallan's stomach twist. And this person was separate from the spy Ile supposedly had among Dalinar's elite? Storms! It was tying Shallan's mind in knots.
Look the body over, Shallan whispered to Ishna. See if you can find evidence if this was self-inflicted or if someone else killed her. Yes, Brightness.
Shallan quickly walked back into the room with the wine hutch. Gaz and Red were already working to gather Ile's things. Storms. Could she trust these two? In any case, Ile's prediction had proven correct. And it was possible that this room held secrets Marais didn't want Shallan to find.
8. Surrender.
A bronze cage can create a warning fabrial, alerting one to objects or entities nearby. Heliodors are being used for this currently, and there is some good reasoning for this, but other gemstones should be viable. Lectron Fabrial Mechanics, presented by Navani Kolin to the Coalition of Monarchs, Urethiru, Yesavan, 1175.
Kaladin crossed the burning room, haunted by that moment when he'd suddenly lost his powers. The experience left him rattled. The truth was, he had come to rely upon his abilities, like he relied on a good spear, battle-tested and sharp. There was little worse than having your weapon fail you in battle.
We're going to have to watch for those fabrials, Kaladin said. I don't like the idea of our powers being subject to removal by the enemy.
He glanced at Syl, who sat on his shoulder. Have you experienced anything like that before?
She shook her head. Not that I remember. It made me feel faded, as if I wasn't quite here.
He shied away from rooms consumed by the blaze, full of primal shadows and lights, bright orange and red, deep and angry colors. If the city lords had been content with a normal house, this could never have happened. But no, they needed to be set apart, on a home full of delicate wood instead of sturdy stone. The hungry flames seemed excited as they played with the dying manor. There was a glee to the sounds of the fire, its roars and hisses. Flamespren ran up the wall alongside him, leaving tracks of black on the wood. Ahead, the kitchen was fully engulfed. He didn't mind the heat so far. His stormlight healed burns before they had a chance to more than itch. As long as he stayed away from the heart of the fire, he should be all right. Unfortunately, that might prove impossible.
Where's the cellar? Syl asked from his shoulder.
Kaladin pointed through the kitchen inferno toward a doorway, barely visible as a shadow.
Great, Syl said. You going to run for it?
Kaladin nodded, not daring to lose his stormlight by speaking. He braced himself, then dashed into the room, flames and smoke curling around him. A forlorn groaning sound from above indicated that the ceiling was close to giving in. A quick lashing upward let Kaladin leap the burning kitchen counter. He landed on the other side and slammed his shoulder into the charred door to the cellar, breaking through with a loud crash, bits of flame and soot spraying before him. He entered a dark tunnel sloping downward, cut directly into the rock of the hillside. As he moved away from the inferno behind, Syl giggled. What? He asked.
Your backside's on fire, she said.
Damnation. He batted at the back of his coat. Well, after getting stabbed by Leshwy, this uniform was ruined anyway. He was going to have to listen to Leighton complain about how often Kaladin went through them. The Windrunner quartermaster seemed convinced that Kaladin let himself get hit solely to make it difficult to keep uniforms in supply. He started through the Darkstone Tunnel, counting on his stormlight to provide illumination. Soon after entering, he crossed a metal grate covering a deep pit, the water catch, to divert rainwater that flooded the tunnel. A storm cellar like this was where light-eyed families retreated during high storms. He'd have dismissed potential flooding as another problem with living in a wooden home, but even stone houses occasionally got damaged during storms. He didn't blame anyone for wanting to put several feet of rock between them and the raging winds. He had played down here with Laurel as a child, and it seemed smaller to him now. He remembered a deep, endless tunnel, but soon after he passed the water catch, he saw the lit cellar room ahead. As Kaladin stepped into the underground room, he found two prisoners, manacled to the far wall, slumped in place, their heads bowed. He didn't recognize one of them, perhaps he was a refugee, but the other was Jeeber, father to a couple of boys Kaladin had known as a youth.
Jeeber, Kaladin said, hurrying forward. Have you seen Roshon? He...
Kaladin trailed off as he noticed that neither person was moving. He knelt, feeling a growing dread as he got a better glimpse of Jeeber's lean face. It was perfectly normal, save for the pale cast, and the two burned-out pits like charcoal in place of the eyes. He'd been killed with a shard blade.
Kaladin, Syl said, behind you!
He spun, thrusting out his hand and summoning his blade. The rough-hewn room sloped back to the left of the doorway, making a small alcove that Kaladin hadn't been able to see when first entering. There, standing quietly, was a tall man with a hawkish face, brown hair flecked with black. Moash wore a sharp black uniform cut after the Alethi style and held Brightlord Roshon in front of him with a knife to the man's neck. The former city lord was crying silently, Moash's other hand covering his mouth, Fierce-Bren undulating on the ground. Moash jerked the knife in a quick, efficient slice, opening Roshon's throat and spilling his lifeblood across the front of his ragged clothing. Roshon fell to the stone. Kaladin shouted, scrambling to help, but the surgeon within him shook his head. A slit throat? That wasn't the kind of wound a surgeon could heal.
Move on to someone you can help, his father seemed to say. This one is dead.
Storms. Was it too late to fetch Lift or Godeki? They could...
Roshon thrashed weakly on the ground before a helpless Kaladin. Then the man who had terrorized Kaladin's family, the man who had consigned Tien to death, simply faded away in a pool of his own blood. Kaladin glared up at Moash, who silently returned his knife to its belt sheath.
You came to save him, didn't you, Cal? Moash asked. One of your worst enemies? Instead of finding vengeance and peace, you run to rescue him.
Kaladin roared, leaping to his feet. Roshon's death sent Kaladin back to that moment in the palace at Kolinar, a spear through Elokar's chest, and Moash giving a Bridge Four salute as if he in any way deserved to claim that privilege. Kaladin raised his Syl spear toward Moash, but the tall man merely looked at him, his eyes now a dark brown, but lacking any emotion or life whatsoever. Moash didn't summon his shard blade.
Fight me, Kaladin shouted at him. Let's do this. No, Moash said, holding his hands up to the sides. I surrender.
Shallan forced herself to stare through the doorway at Iale's body, as Ishna inspected it. Shallan's eyes wanted to glide off the body, look anywhere else, think anything else. Confronting difficult things was a problem for her, but part of finding her balance, three personas, each of them distinctly useful, had come when she'd accepted her pain, even if she didn't deserve it. The balance was working. She was functioning. But are we getting better? Vale asked. Or merely hovering in place? I'll accept not getting worse, Shallan thought. For how long? Vale asked. A year now, of standing in the wind, not sliding backward, but not progressing. You need to start remembering eventually the difficult things. No, not that. Not yet. She had work to do. She turned away from the body, focusing on the problems at hand. Did the Ghost Bloods have spies among Shallan's inner circle? She found the idea not only plausible, but likely. Adolin might be willing to call today's mission a success, and Shallan could accept that successfully infiltrating the Sons of Honor had at least proven that she could plan and execute a mission. But she couldn't help feeling she'd been played by Marais, despite Vale's best efforts.
Nothing in here except some empty wine bottles, Red said, opening drawers and cabinets on the hutch. Wait! I think I found Gaz's sense of humor.
He held up something small between two fingers.
Nope, just a withered old piece of fruit.
Gaz had found a small bedchamber at the rear of the room, through the door that Vale had noticed.
If you do find my sense of humor, kill it, he called from inside. That will be more merciful than forcing it to deal with your jokes, Red.
Brightness Shallan thinks they're funny, right?
Anything that annoys Gaz is funny, Red, she said.
Well, I annoy myself, Gaz called.
He stuck out his head, fully bearded, now with two working eyes, having regrown the missing one after he'd finally learned to draw in Stormlight a few months ago.
So I must be the most hilarious storming man on the planet. What are we searching for, Shallan?
Papers, documents, notebooks, she said. Letters, any kind of writing. The two continued their inspection. They would find anything obvious, but ELA had indicated there was something unusual to be discovered, something hidden, something that Marais wouldn't want Shallan to have. She stepped through the room, then whirled a little on one heel and looked up. How had Vale missed the fine scrollwork paint near the ceiling, ringing the room? And the rug in the center might have been monochrome, but it was thick and well-maintained. She kicked off her shoes and stockings and walked across it, feeling the luxurious threads under her toes. The room was understated, yes, but not bleak. Secrets. Where were the secrets? Pattern hummed on her skirt as she stepped over to the hutch and inspected the wines. Iale had mentioned a rare vintage. These wines were the clue. Nothing to do but try them. Shallan had suffered far worse tests in the course of her duties. Red gave her a cocked eyebrow as she began pouring and tasting a little of each. Despite Iale's lengthy rumination on the wines, most of them tasted distinctly ordinary to Shallan. She wasn't an expert, though. She favored anything that tasted good and got her drunk. Thinking of that, she took in a little Stormlight and burned away the effects of the alcohol. Now wasn't the time for a muddy head. Though most of the wines were ordinary, she did land on one she couldn't place. It was a sweet wine, deep red, bloody in color. It didn't taste like anything she'd had before. Fruity, yet robust. And perhaps a little bit
Heavy. Was that the right word?
I've got some letters here, Gaz said from the bedroom. There are also some books that seem like she hand-wrote them.
Gather it all, Shallan said. We'll sort it out later. I need to go ask Adolin something.
She carried the carafe out to him. Several guards watched the door, and it didn't seem anyone in the war camp had noticed the attack. At least, no one had come knocking. Shallan pointedly ignored, then forced herself to look at, the body again. Adolin stepped over to meet her, speaking softly.
We should get going. A couple of the guards escaped. We might want to write for some windrunners to meet us for quicker extraction. And what happened to your shoes?
Shallan glanced at her bare feet, which poked out from under her dress.
They were impeding my ability to think.
Adolin
ran a hand through his delightfully messy hair, blonde speckled with black.
Love, you're deliciously weird sometimes.
The rest of the time, I'm just tastelessly weird.
She held up the carafe.
Drink. It's for science.
He frowned, but tried a sip, then grimaced.
What is it? She asked.
Shin wine. They have no idea how to ferment a proper alcohol. They make it all out of the same strange little berry.
Exotic indeed, Shallan said. We can't leave quite yet. Pattern and I have a secret to tease out.
Pattern said from her skirt. I wish I had shoes to take off so my brain would work right.
He paused.
Actually, I don't think I have a brain.
We'll be back in a second, she said, returning to the room with the wine hutch.
Red had joined Gaz in the extremely tiny bedchamber. There were no windows, with barely enough room to stand. It held a mattress with no frame and a trunk that apparently stored the notes and letters Gaz had gathered. ELA would expect those to be found. There might be secrets in them, but not what Shallan hunted.
ELA moved here after her palace burned down. She slept in a closet and refused to leave this fortress. And still Marais got not one but two people in to kill her.
Shin wine? Was that the clue? Something about the hutch?
She glanced it over, then got out her sketch pad.
Pattern, she said. Search the room for patterns.
Pattern hummed and moved off her skirt, rippling the floor as he moved across it, as if he were somehow inside the stone, making the surface bulge. As he began searching, she did a sketch of the hutch. There was something about committing an object to memory, then freezing it into a drawing, that let her see better. She could judge the spaces between the drawers, the thickness of the wood, and she soon knew there was no room in the hutch for hidden compartments. She shooed away a couple of creation spren, then stood. Patterns, patterns, patterns. She scanned the carpet, then the painted designs on the upper trim of the room.
Shinovar.
Was the shin wine truly important? Or had she mistaken the clue?
Shallan, Pattern said from across the room. A pattern!
Shallan hurried to where he dimpled the rock of the wall, near the far northwest corner. Kneeling, she found that the stones did have a faint pattern to them. Carvings that, worn by time, she could barely feel beneath her fingers.
This building, she said, it's not new.
At least part of it was already standing when the Alethi arrived at the war camps. They built the structure on an already set foundation.
What are the markings? I can barely make them out.
10 items in a pattern, repeating, he said.
This one feels a little like a glyph, she thought.
These war camps dated back to the shadow days when the epic kingdoms had stood. 10 kingdoms of humankind. 10 glyphs? She wasn't certain she could interpret ancient glyphs.
Even Yasna might have had trouble with that. But maybe she didn't have to. These stones run around the base of the wall, Shallan said. Let's see if any of the other carvings are easier to make out. A few of the stones were indeed better preserved. They each bore a glyph, and what appeared to be a small map, in the shape of one of the old kingdoms. Most were indistinct blobs, but the crescent shape of Shinovar's mountains stood out. Shinwine. A map with the Shinovar mountains. Find every block with this shape on it, she told Pattern. He did so, every tenth block. She moved along to each one, until on the third try, the stone wiggled. Here, she said, in the corner. I think this is right. He said. A few degrees off. So technically acute. She carefully slid the stone out. Inside, like the mythical gemstone cache from a bedtime tale, she found a small notebook. She glanced up and checked whether Gaz and Red were still in the other room. They were. Damnation! She has me distrusting my own agents, Shallan thought, slipping the notebook into her safe pouch and replacing the stone. Maybe ELA's only plan had been to sow chaos, distrust. But Shallan couldn't entirely accept that theory, not with how haunted ELA had seemed. It wasn't hard to believe the ghost bloods had been hunting her. Marais had infiltrated Amaram and ELA's inner circle a year ago, but hadn't gone with them when they'd fled Urethiru. Though Shallan itched to peek through the notebook, Gaz and Red emerged with a pillowcase full of notes and letters.
If there's anything more in there, Gaz said, thumbing over his shoulder, we can't find it.
It will have to do, Shallan said, as Adolin waved her to join him. Let's get out of here.
Kaladin hesitated, spear held toward Moash's throat. He could end the man, should end the man. Why did he hesitate? Moash had been his friend. They'd spent hours by the fire talking about their lives. Kaladin had opened his heart to this man in ways he hadn't to most of the others. He'd told Moash, like Teft and Rock, of Tien, of Rishon, of his fears. Moash wasn't just a friend, though. He was beyond that a member of Bridge Four. Kaladin had sworn to the storms and the heavens above, if anyone was there watching, that he'd protect those men. Kaladin had failed Moash, as soundly as he'd failed Dunny, Mart, and Jax. And of them all, losing Moash hurt the most, because in those callous eyes, Kaladin saw himself. You bastard, Kaladin hissed. You deny that I was justified, Moash kicked at Rishon's body. You know what he did. You know what he cost me. You killed Elakar for that crime. Because he deserved it, like this one did. Moash shook his head. I did this for you too, Cal. You would let your brother's soul cry in the storms unavenged? Don't you dare speak of Tien! Kaladin shouted. He felt himself slipping, losing control. It happened whenever he thought of Moash, of King Elakar dying, of failing the people of Kolinar and the men of the Wall Guard. You claim justice? Kaladin demanded, waving toward the corpses chained to the wall. What about Jeeber and that other man? You killed them for justice? For mercy, Moash said. Better a quick death than to leave them to die, forgotten. You could have set them free! Kaladin's hands were sweaty on his weapon, and his mind. His mind wouldn't think straight. His stormlight was running low, almost out.
Kaladin, Syl said, let's leave.
We have to deal with him, Kaladin whispered. I have to... What? Kill Moash while he stood defenseless? This was a man Kaladin was supposed to protect, to save. They're going to die, you know,
Moesh said softly. Shut up! Everyone you love, everyone you think you can protect. They're all going to die anyway. There's nothing you can do about it.
I said shut up! Kaladin shouted.
Moesh stepped toward the spear, dropping his hands to his sides as he took a second step. Kaladin, strangely, felt himself shying away. He'd been so tired lately, and while he tried to ignore it, tried to keep going on, his fatigue seemed a sudden weight. Kaladin had used a lot of his stormlight fighting, then getting through the fire. It ran out right then, and he deflated. The numbness he'd been shoving down this entire battle flooded into him. The exhaustion. Beyond Moesh, the distant fire crackled and snapped. Far off, a loud crashing crunch echoed through the tunnel, the kitchen ceiling finally collapsing. Bits of burning wood tumbled down the tunnel, the embers fading to darkness.
Do you remember the chasm, Cal? Moesh whispered. In the rain that night. Standing there, looking down into the darkness and knowing it was your sole release. You knew it then. You try to pretend you've forgotten. But you know. As sure as the storms will come, as sure as every light eyes will lie. There is only one answer, one path, one result. No. Kaladin whispered. I've found the better way, Moesh said. I feel no guilt. I've given it away, and in so doing became the person I could always have become if I hadn't been restrained. You've become a monster. I can take away the pain, Cal. Isn't that what you want? An end to your suffering?
Kaladin felt like he was in a trance, frozen as he'd been when he watched Elokar die. A disconnect that had festered inside him ever since. No, it had been growing for longer, a seed that made him incapable of fighting, of deciding, paralyzing him while his friends died. His spear slipped from his fingers. Syl was talking, but he couldn't hear her. Her voice was a distant breeze.
There's a simple path to freedom, Moesh said, reaching out and putting his hand on Kaladin's shoulder, a comforting, familiar gesture. You are my dearest friend, Cal. I want you to stop hurting. I want you to be free. No. The answer is to stop existing, Cal. You've always known it, haven't you?
Kaladin blinked away tears in the deepest part of him. The little boy who hated the rain and the darkness withdrew into his soul and curled up because he did want to stop hurting. He wanted it so badly.
I need one thing from you, Moesh said. I need you to admit that I'm right. I need you to see. As they keep dying, remember. As you fail them and the pain consumes you, remember there is a way out. Step back up to that cliff and jump into the darkness.
Syl was screaming. But it was only wind, a distant wind.
But I won't fight you, Cal, Moesh whispered. There is no fight to be won. We lost the moment we were born into this cursed life of suffering. The sole victory left to us is to choose to end it. I found my way. There is one open to you. Oh, Stormfather, Kaladin thought. Oh, Almighty, I just want to stop failing the people I love.
Light exploded into the room, clean and white like the light of the brightest diamond. the light of the sun. A brilliant, concentrated purity. Moash growled, spinning around, shading his eyes against the source of the light, which came from the doorway. The figure behind it wasn't visible as anything more than a shadow. Moash shied away from the light, but a version of him, transparent and filmy, broke off and stepped toward the light instead, like an afterimage. In it, Kaladin saw the same Moash, but somehow standing taller, wearing a brilliant blue uniform. This one raised a hand, confident, and although Kaladin couldn't see them, he knew people gathered behind this Moash. Protected. Safe. The image of Moash burst alight as a shard spear formed in his hands.
No! The real Moash screamed. No! Take it! Take my pain!
He stumbled away to the side of the room, furious, a shard blade, the blade of the assassin in white, forming in his hands. He swung at the empty air. Finally, he lowered his head, shadowing his face with his elbow, and shoved past the figure in the light and rushed back up the tunnel. Kaladin knelt, bathed in that warm light. Yes, warmth. Kaladin felt warm. Surely, if there truly was a deity, it watched him from within that light. The light faded, and a spindly young man with blackened blonde hair rushed forward to grab Kaladin.
Sir, Renarin asked. Kaladin, sir? Are you all right? Are you out of Stormlight?
Kaladin shook his head.
What?
Come on, Renarin said, getting under his arm to help lift him.
The fused have retreated. The ship is ready to leave.
Kaladin nodded, numb, and let Renarin help him stand. 9. Contradictions.
A pewter cage will cause the spren of your fabrile to express its attribute in force. A flame spren, for example, will create heat. We call these augmenters. They tend to use stormlight more quickly than other fabrials. Lectron Fabrial Mechanics, presented by Navani Kolin to the Coalition of Monarchs, Urethiru, Yesavan, 1175.
By the time Kaladin started to come to himself, the fourth bridge had already begun lifting into the air. He stood near the railing, watching Hearthstone, now abandoned, shrinking beneath them. From this distance, the houses resembled a group of discarded crab shells, shed as the creature grew. Their function served, they were now scattered refuse. Once he'd imagined returning to this place triumphant. Instead, that return had eventually brought the town's end. It surprised him how little it hurt, knowing he'd probably visited his birthplace for the last time. Well, it hadn't been home to him in years. Instinctively, he searched out the soldiers of Bridge 4. They were mingled among the other windrunners and squires on the upper deck, crowding around, talking about something Kaladin couldn't make out. The group was so big now, hundreds of windrunners, far too many to function as the tight-knit group he'd formed in Sadius's army. A groan escaped his lips, and he blamed it on his fatigue. He settled down on the deck and put his back to the railing. One of the Ardents brought him a cup of something warm, which he took gratefully, until he realized the drinks were distributed to the townspeople and refugees, not the other soldiers. Did he look so bad? Yes, he thought, glancing down at his bloodied and burned uniform. He vaguely remembered stumbling up to the ship with Renarin's help, then barking at the flood of windrunners who came to fawn over him. They kept offering him stormlight, but he had plenty. It surged in his veins now, but for once the extra energy it lent seemed wan, faded. Stop, he thought forcefully. You've held yourself together in rougher winds than this, Kaladin. Breathe deeply, it will pass. It always does. He sipped his drink, which turned out to be broth. He welcomed its warmth, especially as the ship gained elevation.
Many of the townspeople gathered near the sides, Ospren bursting around them. Kaladin forced out a smile as he closed his eyes and leaned his head back, trying to recapture the wondrous feeling of taking to the air those first few times. Instead, he found himself reliving other darker times, when Tien had died, and when he'd failed Elokar. Foolish though it was, the second one hurt almost as much as the first. He hadn't particularly liked the king, yet somehow, seeing Elokar die as he nearly spoke the first radiant ideal. Kaladin opened his eyes as Syl flew up in the form of a miniature fourth bridge. She often took the shape of natural things, but this one seemed extra odd. It didn't belong in the sky. One might argue that Kaladin didn't either. She reformed into the shape of a young woman, wearing her more stately dress, and landed at eye level. She waved toward the gathered windrunners.
"They're congratulating Lauren," Syl explained. "She spoke the third ideal while we were in that burning building."
Kaladin grunted. "Good for her."
"Are you going to congratulate her?"
"Later," Kaladin said. "Don't want to force my way through the crowd." He sighed, pressing his head back against the railing again. "Why didn't I kill him?" he thought. "I'll kill Parshman and Fused for existing, but when I face Moash, I lock up? Why?" He felt so stupid. How had he been so easy to manipulate? Why hadn't he simply rammed his spear into Moash's too-confident face and saved the world a whole ton of hassle? At the least, it would have shut the man up, stopped the words that dripped from his mouth like sludge. "They're going to die. Everyone you love, everyone you think you can protect, they're all going to die anyway. There's nothing you can do about it. I can take away the pain." Kaladin forced his eyes open and found Syl standing before him wearing her more usual dress, the flowing girlish one that faded to mist around her knees. She seemed smaller than normal.
"I don't know what to do," she said softly. "To help you."
He glanced down.
"The darkness in you is better sometimes, worse others," she said. "But lately, it's grown into something different. You seem so tired."
"I just need some good rest," Kaladin said. "You think I'm bad now? You should have seen me after Hav made me hike at double time across. He turned away. Lying to himself was one thing. Lying to Syl was harder. "Moash did something to me," he said. "Put me into some kind of trance."
"I don't think he did, Kaladin," she whispered. "How did he know about the honor chasm and what you nearly did there?"
"I told him a lot of things, back during better days. In Dalinar's army, before Urethiru, before..." Why couldn't he remember those times, the warm times, sitting at the fire with real friends? Real friends, including a man who had just tried to persuade him to go kill himself.
"Kaladin," Syl said, "it's getting worse. This distance to your expression, this fatigue. It happens whenever you run out of stormlight, as if you can only keep going while it's in you."
He squeezed his eyes shut.
"You freeze whenever you hear reports of lost windrunners."
When he heard of his soldiers dying, he always imagined running bridges again. He heard the screams, felt the arrows in the air.
"Please," she whispered, "tell me what to do. I can't understand this about you. I've tried so hard. I can't seem to make sense of how you feel or why you feel that way."
"If you ever do figure it out," he said, "explain it to me, will you?" Why couldn't he simply shrug off what Moash had said? Why couldn't he stand up tall, stride toward the sun like the hero everyone pretended he was? He opened his eyes and took a sip of his broth, but it had gone cold. He forced it down anyway. Soldiers couldn't afford to be picky about nourishment. Before long, a figure broke from the crowd of windrunners and ambled toward him.
Teft's uniform fit neatly and his beard was trimmed, but he seemed like an old stone now that he wasn't glowing anymore. The type of mossy stone you found sitting at the base of a hill marked by rain and the winds of time. It left you wondering what it had seen in its many days. Teft started to sit next to Kaladin.
I don't want to talk, Kaladin snapped. I'm fine. You don't need to—
Oh, shut up, Cal, Teft said, sighing as he settled down. He was in his early 50s, but sometimes acted like a grandfather some 20 years older.
In a minute here, you're going to go congratulate that girl for saying her third ideal. It was rough on her, like it is on most of us. She needs to see your approval.
A protest died on Kaladin's lips. Yes, he was High Marshal now, but the truth was every officer worth his chips knew there was a time to shut your mouth and do what your sergeant told you. Even if he wasn't your sergeant anymore. Even if there wasn't a squad anymore. Teft looked up at the sky.
So the bastard is still alive, is he?
We had a confirmed sighting of him 2 months ago at that battle on the Vaden border, Kaladin said.
Aye, 2 months ago, Teft said. But I figured someone on their side would have killed him by now. Have to assume they can't stand him either.
They gave him an honor blade, Kaladin said. If they can't stand him, they have an odd way of showing it.
What did he say?
That you were all going to die, Kaladin said.
Ha! Empty threats. He's gone crazy, that one has.
Yeah, Kaladin said. Crazy. It wasn't a threat, though, Kaladin thought. I am going to lose everyone eventually. That's how it works. That's how it always works.
I'll tell the others he's sniffing around, Teft said. He might try to attack some of us in the future.
Teft eyed him.
Renarin said he found you kneeling there, no weapon in hand, like you'd frozen in battle.
Teft left the sentence dangling, implying a little more. Like you'd frozen in battle again. It hadn't happened that often, only this time, and that time in Kolinar, and the time when Lopin had nearly died a few months back, and, well, a few others. Let's go talk to Lauren, Kaladin said, standing up.
Lad, you told me I had to do this, Teft, Kaladin said. You can storming let me get to it.
Teft fell in behind him as Kaladin went and did his duty. He let them see him stand tall, let them be reassured he was still the brilliant leader they all knew. He had Lauren summon her new blade for him, and he congratulated her spren. They had few enough honor spren that he tried to always acknowledge them. Afterward, as he'd hoped, Dalinar requested Windrunners to fly him, Navani, and a few of the others to the Shattered Plains. Many of the Radiants would stay behind to guard the Fourth Bridge as it made its longer voyage, but the command staff was needed for other duties. After seeing to his parents, who of course decided to stay with the townspeople, Kaladin took off. At least with the wind rushing around them during flight, Teft couldn't ask any more questions.
Navani both loved and detested contradictions. On the one hand, contradictions in nature or science were testaments to the logical, reasonable order of all things. When 100 items indicated a pattern, then one broke that pattern, it showcased how remarkable the pattern was in the first place. Deviation highlighted natural variety. On the other hand, that deviant stood out, like a fraction on a page of integers, a 7 within a sequence of otherwise sublime multiples of 2. Contradictions whispered that her knowledge was incomplete. Or, worse, that maybe there was no sequence. Maybe everything was random chaos, and she pretended the world made sense for her own peace of mind. Navani flipped through her notes. Her featureless round chamber was too small to stand up in. It had a table, bolted to the floor, and a single chair. She could touch the walls to both sides simultaneously by stretching out her arms. A goblet to hold spheres was affixed to the table, and fastened shut at the top. She'd brought only diamonds for light, naturally. She couldn't stand when her light was made up of 100 different colors and sizes of gems. She stretched her legs forward under the table, sighing. Hours spent in this room made her long to get up and go for a walk. That wasn't a possibility, so instead she laid out the offending pages on her desk. Yasna enjoyed finding inconsistencies in data. Navani's daughter seemed to thrive on contradictions, little deviations in witness testimony, questions raised by a historical account's biased recollections. Yasna picked carefully at such threads, pulling at them to discover new insights and secrets. Yasna loved secrets. Navani was more wary of them. Secrets had turned Gavilar into whatever it was he'd been at the end. Even today, the greed of Artifabrians across the world prevented the greater society from learning, growing, and creating, all in the name of preserving trade secrets. How many secrets had the ancient Radiance preserved for centuries, only to lose them in death, forcing Navani to have to discover everything anew? She reached down beside her chair and picked up the Fabriel Kaladin and Lift had discovered. She had no idea what to make of the thing. A collection of 4 garnets? No spren appeared to be trapped in any of them. She didn't recognize the metal of its cage, the cut of its gemstones. Studying the thing was like trying to understand a foreign language. How had it suppressed the Radiant's abilities? Was this related to the gemstones embedded in the weapons of the enemy soldiers? The ones that drained away Stormlight? So many storming secrets. She held up a sketch of the gemstone pillar at the heart of Urithiru. It is the same, she thought, turning the fabril in her hand, then comparing it to a similar-looking construction of garnets in the picture. The ones in the pillar were enormous, but the cut, the arrangement of stones, the feel was the same. Why would the tower have a device to suppress the powers of Radiance? It was their home. Could it be the opposite? She thought, putting down the alien fabril and making a note in the margins of the drawing. A way to suppress the abilities of the fused? So much about the tower still didn't make any sense. She had a bondsmith in Dalinar. Shouldn't he and the Stormfather be able to mimic whatever the long-dead tower spren had done to power the pillar and the tower? She held up a second picture, this one of a more familiar device, a construction of 3 gemstones connected by chains, meant to be worn on the back of the hand. A soul caster. Soul casters had long bothered Navani. They were the proverbial flaw in the system, the fabril that didn't make sense. Navani wasn't a scholar herself, but she had a strong working knowledge of fabrils. They produced certain effects, mostly amplifying, locating, or attracting specific elements or emotions, always tied to the type of spren trapped inside. The effects were so logical that theoretical fabrils had been correctly predicted years before their successful construction. A technological masterpiece like the 4th Bridge was no more than a collection of smaller, simpler devices intertwined. Pair one set of gemstones, and you had a span read. Interwork hundreds, and you could make a ship fly. Assuming you'd discovered how to isolate planes of motion and reapply force vectors through conjoined fabrials. But even these discoveries had been more small tweaks than revolutionary changes. Each step built on the previous ones in logical ways. It made perfect sense once you understood the fundamentals. But soul casters? They broke all the rules. For centuries, everyone had explained them as holy objects, created by the Almighty and granted to men in an act of charity. They weren't supposed to make sense, because they weren't technological, but divine. But was that really true? Or could she, with study, eventually discover their secrets? For years, they'd assumed no Spren were trapped in soul-casting devices. But with the Oath Gates, Navani could travel into Shadesmar, and everything in the physical realm reflected there. Human beings manifested as floating candle flames. Spren manifested as larger or more complete versions of what was seen in the physical realm. Soulcasters manifested as small, unresponsive Spren, hovering with their eyes closed. So the soulcasters did have a captured Spren, a radiant Spren, judging by their shape, intelligent, rather than the more animal-like Spren captured to power normal Fabrials. These Spren were held captive in Shadesmar and made to power soulcasters. Is this the same, perhaps? Navani thought, holding up the gemstone device Kaladin had discovered. There had to be a connection, and perhaps a connection to the tower? The secret to making it function? Navani shuffled through pages in her notebook, looking at the multitude of schematics she'd drawn during the last year. She'd been able to piece together many of the tower's mechanics, though they were, like soulcasters, created by somehow trapping Spren in Shadesmar. Their functions, however, were similar to the ones designed by modern artifabrians. The moving lifts, a combination of conjoined fabrials, and a hidden water wheel that dipped into an underground river which flowed from melting snow in the peaks. The city's wells, constantly replenished with fresh water. A clever manipulation of attractor fabrials, powered by ancient gemstones exposed to the air and the storms far beneath the tower. Indeed, the more she studied Urethiru, the more she saw the ancients using simple fabrial technology to create their marvels. Modern artifabrians had exceeded such constructs. Her engineers had repaired, refitted, and streamlined the lifts, making them function at several times their original speed. They'd enhanced the wells and pipes, which could now draw water farther up the tower into long-abandoned waterways. She'd learned so much in the last year. She'd almost started to feel she could deduce it all, answer the questions pertaining to time and to creation itself. Then she remembered soulcasters. Their armies ate and remained mobile because of soulcasters. Urethiru depended on extra food from soulcasters. The soulcaster cache discovered in Aemia earlier in the year had brought an incredible boon to the Coalition armies. They were among the most coveted, important devices in modern history, and she didn't know how they worked. Navani sighed, snapping her notebook shut. Her little room trembled as she did so, and she frowned, leaning to the side and opening a small hatch in the wall. She looked out through the glass at an incongruous sight. A group of people flying in the air alongside her. The wind runners held a loose formation, facing into the wind, which Navani had pointed out was a little ridiculous. Why not fly the other way? You didn't need to see where you were going. They'd claimed that flying feet first felt silly, and had refused, no matter how much sense it made. They did seem to sculpt the air around themselves, and prevent their faces from being buffeted by the worst of the winds. Dalinar, however, had no such protection. He flew in the line, kept aloft by a windrunner, and wore a face mask with goggles to keep his proud nose from freezing right off. Navani opted for a more comfortable conveyance. Her room was a person-size wooden sphere with long tapering points at either end, to help with airflow. The simple vehicle was infused by a windrunner, then lashed into the sky. This way Navani could ride in comfort and get some studying done during extended travel. Dalinar claimed that he liked the feeling of the wind in his face, but Navani suspected that he found her vehicle too close to an airborne version of a palanquin, a woman's vehicle. One might assume that, in deciding to learn how to read, Dalinar would no longer worry about what was traditionally considered masculine or feminine. But the male ego could be as complicated as the most intricate fabrial. She smiled at his mask and three layers of coats. Nearby, lithe scouts in blue flitted one way or another. Dalinar looked like a chull that had found itself among a flock of sky eels and was doing its best to pretend to fit in. She loved that chull, loved his stubbornness, the concern he took for every decision, the way he thought with intense passion. You never got half of Dalinar Kolin. When he put his mind to something, you got the whole man and had to simply pray to the Almighty that you could handle him. She checked her clock. A trip like this, all the way from Alethkar to the Shattered Plains, still took close to 6 hours, and that was with a triple lashing, using Dalinar's power to provide stormlight. Thankfully, they were nearing the end, and she saw the Shattered Plains approaching ahead. Her engineers had been busy. Over the last year, they'd constructed sturdy permanent bridges connecting many of the relevant plateaus. They desperately needed to be able to farm this region to supply Urethiru, and that meant dealing with Ile Sadius and her rebels. Hopefully, Navani would soon hear good news from the Lightweavers and their mission to... Navani cocked her head, noticing something odd. The wall beside her reflected a faint shade of red, blinking on and off, like the light of a spanreed. Her immediate thought was panic. Had she somehow activated the strange fabrial? If the powers of the Windrunners vanished, she'd drop from the air like a stone. Her heart leapt, and her breath caught. She didn't start plummeting, and the light wasn't coming from the strange fabrial. She leaned back, then peeked under her table. There, stuck to the bottom with some wax, was a tiny ruby. No, half a ruby. Part of a spanreed, she thought, picking it free with her fingernail. She held it up between her fingers and studied the steady, pulsing light. Yes, this was a spanreed ruby. When inserted into a spanreed, it would connect her to someone with the other half, allowing them to communicate. It had clearly been stuck here for her to find. But who would do it so sneakily? The Windrunners began lowering her vehicle down near the center of the Shattered Plains, and she found herself increasingly excited by the blinking light. A span reed wouldn't work if she was in a moving vehicle, but as they landed, she dug one of her own reeds from her supplies. She had the new ruby affixed and a piece of paper in place before anyone had time to check on her. She turned the ruby, eager to see what the unknown figure wanted to say to her. "You must stop what you are doing," the pen wrote out, using a cramped, nearly illegible version of the Alethi women's script. "Immediately." It waited for a response. What a strange message. Navani turned the ruby and wrote her response, which would be copied for whoever had the other side of the ruby. "I'm not sure what you mean," she wrote. "Who are you? I don't believe I'm doing anything that needs to be halted. Perhaps you don't know the identity of the person you are writing to. Has this spanreed been misplaced?" Navani set the spanreed into position for a response, then turned the ruby. When she removed her hand, the pen remained in position on the paper, upright. Then it started moving on its own, worked by the unseen person on the other end. "I know who you are," it wrote. "You are the monster Navani Kolin. You have caused more pain than any living person." She cocked her head. "What? On Roshar?" "I couldn't watch any longer," the pen continued. "I had to stop you." Was it a mad woman who wrote with the other reed? The ruby started blinking, indicating they wanted a response. All right, Navani wrote. Why don't you tell me what it is you want me to stop? Also, you have neglected to give me your name. The response came quickly, written as if by a fervent hand. You capture Spren. You imprison them. Hundreds of them. You must stop. Stop, or there will be consequences. Spren? Fabrials? This woman couldn't seriously be concerned about such a simple thing, could she? What was next? Complaining about chulls that pull carts? I have spoken with intelligent Spren, Navani wrote, such as those bonded to the Radiance. They agree that the Spren we use for our Fabrials are not people, but are as unthinking as animals. They may not like the idea of what we do, but they don't think it monstrous. Even the Honor Spren accept it. The Honor Spren cannot be trusted, the pen wrote. Not anymore. You must stop creating this new kind of Fabrial. I will make you stop. This is your warning. The pen halted, and try though she might, Navani couldn't get any further responses from the mysterious woman, or Ardent, who had written to her. The Windrunners at Urithiru had been called to one of the battlefronts for air support, and Kaladin was still busy with his little enterprise in Alethkar. So in the end, Shallan and her team had to travel to Narak the hard way. Fortunately, the hard way wasn't too bad these days. With permanent bridges and a direct path maintained by soldiers, a journey that had once taken days had been reduced to a few hours. At the first main fortified plateau, where Dalinar kept standing troops to watch the war camps, Shallan and Adolin were able to deliver up the prisoners with instructions for them to be brought to Narak for questioning. Adolin and Shallan requisitioned a carriage and left the rest of the troops to make their way back more slowly. Shallan passed the time looking out the carriage window, listening to the clopping of the horses, and watching the fractured landscape of plateaus and chasms. Once, this had all been so difficult to traverse. Now she did it in a plush carriage and considered that inconvenient compared to being flown about by a windrunner. How would it be once Navani got her flying devices working efficiently? Would flying by windrunner be the inconvenience then? Adolin scooted over beside her, and she felt his warmth. She closed her eyes and melted into him, breathing him in, as if she could feel his soul brushing against her own. Hey, he said. It's not so bad, really. Father knew this plan might come to fighting. If ELA had been willing to quietly rule in the war camps, we'd have left her alone. But we couldn't ignore someone sitting in our backyard raising an army to depose us. Shallan nodded. That's not what you're worried about, is it? Adolin asked. No, not completely. She turned and pressed her face into his chest. He'd removed his jacket, and the shirt beneath reminded her of when he came to their rooms after sparring. He always wanted to bathe immediately, and she, well, she rarely let him, not until she was done with him at least. They rode in silence for some time, with Shallan snuggled against him. You never push, she eventually said. Though you know I keep secrets from you. You'll tell me eventually. She gripped his shirt tight between her fingers. It bothers you, though, doesn't it? He didn't reply at first, which was different from his normal cheery assurances. Yeah, he finally said. How could it not? I trust you, Shallan. But sometimes, I wonder if I can trust all three of you. Vale especially. She's trying to protect me in her own way, Shallan said. And if she does something you or I wouldn't want her to? Gets physical with someone?
That's not a worry, Shallan said. I promise, and she will too if you ask her. We have an understanding. I'm not worried about you and me, Adolin.
What are you worried about then?
She pulled closer and couldn't help imagining it. What he would do if he knew the real her. If he knew all the things she'd actually done. It wasn't just about him. What if Pattern knew? Dalinar? Her agents? They would leave, and her life would become a wasteland. She'd be alone, as she deserved. Because of the truths she hid, her entire life was a lie. Shallan, the one they all knew best, was the fakest mask of them all. No, Radiant said. You can face it. You can fight it. You imagine only the worst possible outcome.
But it's possible, isn't it? Shallan asked.
It's possible that they would leave me, if they knew. Radiant had no reply. And deep within Shallan, something else stirred. Formless. She had told herself that she would never create a new persona, and she wouldn't. Formless wasn't real, but the possibility of it frightened Vale, and anything